It's been 40 years since the summer of the Moving Marys in Ireland's County Cork.
One thing led to another. Within a week, thousands of people were arriving every night to the grotto to watch it move.
Coming up, hear about some of the oddest things in Ireland. Or head over to Copenhagen to visualize what the Nordic world was once like at the Viking Ship Museum.
And see a shipbuilders in action, you know, splitting the logs and hammering in the iron nails, and it's really fascinating.
Or make your own special magic, bicycling the legendary Silk Road across Asia. Cooling down on desert night rides in Uzbekistan comes highly recommended.
I feel like I came to know that country more by its constellations than by any terrestrial landmarks. It was absolutely surreal to be sort of flying through the stars in this incredibly flat desert.
Discover the peculiar side of Ireland, Viking sites in Scandinavia, and what a really long bike journey can show you. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Kate Harris is said to have a grudge against borders. She lives off-grid in a cabin up where British Columbia and the Yukon converge near the backside of Southeast Alaska. So for her, the end of the road is always just out of sight. She tells us about her epic bike journey across Central Asia's historic trading route that we call the Silk Road. That's in just a bit. Plus, a guide from Oslo recommends sites where you can get in touch with the Viking spirit of Scandinavia. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves looking at some of the oddities of Ireland. Brinsley McNamara took on the pen name of a late Irish author from his neck of Ireland. He explains that he was too shy to use his own name if he wasn't sure his work chronicling weird Ireland would find an audience. Since 2024, he's been posting short videos on social media about Irish legends and folk cures, cultural ephemera, peculiar happenings, and unidentified Irish objects. He collects them in his book, Weird Ireland, An Unofficial Guide to the Island. Brinsley joins us from his home in County Westmeath.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm actually doing a little better after getting to know your book, Weird Ireland. It's so much fun to travel in Ireland and then to peel back the many layers of fun that Ireland offers and to focus in on its weird side. And I just want to take a few minutes to cover some of the places that were sort of what you call weird happenings. Can you help us out there?
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. So you talk about the Summer of the Moving Marys. That was back in 1985. What was going on in Ireland then?
That's one of my favorite ones. So the summer of 1985, a statue of the Virgin Mary in County Cork in Ballinspittle in a grotto was spotted moving by a woman who looked after the grotto statue. One thing led to another. Within a week, thousands of people were arriving every night to the grotto to watch it move. Camera crews were there within a week, and this led to genuinely a sensation across the country until that October, where statues of the Virgin Mary were reported being seen moving in counties all over the country.
Well, you know, it's interesting because somebody can report, oh, I saw something in the clouds, or my toast looked like the Virgin Mary or whatever. And people go, yeah, yeah, yeah. But if a bunch of people then come and see it, suddenly it takes on a little bit of credibility, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. They always do say about it, though, that the movement doesn't work in the camera footage. But there is a lot of people, thousands of people who did report seeing it move. Even people who don't believe anything supernatural was happening still right. Believe they saw it moving.
But it did come to a brutal end that October.
A dramatic ending. October of that year, three guys drove down from Dublin with hammers. They ran up the hill in full view of a crowd, smashed the statue to pieces, got back in the car, drove away. They were arrested down the road. They actually never did any prison time, I don't think. And the statue was repaired, thankfully. The guy who made it in the 50s was still alive and was still able to fix it.
Nice. Hey, another one of your weird happenings in your book is called The Holy Stump of Rathkeel in County Limerick.
That's a really similar story, actually. That was in 2009. There were some maintenance workers at a church in Rathkeel, County Limerick, and they saw down the trunk of a tree, and one of the workers saw within the grain of the tree what looked like the outline of the Virgin Mary. What happened then was in the weeks after that, every night, hundreds of people would come and pray at this and sort of revere at this holy stump. And it came to a very similar ending when about a month later, it was vandalized with graffiti.
Yeah.
Although it is still there to this day.
Okay, but during its heyday of this stump, what does the church do about that? Because you've got, of course, Ireland is very devoutly Roman Catholic. You've got the Pope and the Vatican, and then you've also got the priests and so on that are there, you know, immersed in the excitement and the energy of their various parishes. Well, what did the Irish Church respond to something like this when people are seeing Mary and Jesus in a stump?
Oddly enough, they're really not into it with both moving statues and the stump. They're very hesitant to say that there's any kind of anything miraculous happening.
Okay, so the church is not a big cheerleader of this kind of religion.
No, they're not. Oddly enough, they are not.
Okay, another one of your weird happenings is a sports thing. It's the All-Ireland, how do you pronounce it, Pukfada Championships.
Pukfada, you got it right. So in County Louth, it's, I don't know if you're familiar with the game hurling, the Irish game hurling.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like airborne hockey with no injury timeouts. It's really fast and kind of brutal.
You synopsized that better than I could have. Now let's imagine that instead of being played in a pitch, what's happening is you need to cast a ball across a mountain range about 5 kilometers.
Okay, casting meaning you're hurling it with a hurling stick?
With a hurling stick, that's right.
So you got this hard ball. I mean, it's like it makes a hard baseball seem soft. And you hurl it with this hockey stick that's kind of like a big spoon. Mm-hmm. And you're instead of trying to get across the goal line, you're trying to go, what, 5 kilometers over a mountain pass?
Over a whole mountain range, yeah. It sounds like a bizarre sporting event. It only happens in one place in the world, one day of the year.
Ah.
And the winner is whoever can get it across 5 kilometers in the fewest... a puck is what means when you hit the ball, yeah.
You hit it. You don't hurl
it.
So it's,
yeah, you
so
hit
you,
it, yeah.
You put it up in the, you throw it up in there and then you whack it like somebody who's pitching to themselves with a baseball bat.
Exactly. That's exactly what you do.
Okay, so you whack it. And it's not a matter of speed. It's a matter of how many whacks.
Exactly. It's a matter of, it's more efficiency. Yeah, absolutely. It's not a game of speed.
Oh, I would love to see that. Is it televised?
No, it's not. And it's very specifically in Ravensdale in the mountains in County Louth. Anyone's free to go to it, but it's a very specific once in a world thing.
And that's Pukfada, P-O-C-F-A-D-A. I'm going to put that on my list. Brinsley McNamara is taking us to the more unconventional events and places in Ireland right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He posts videos in a podcast at his Weird Ireland channel on YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. His book is also called Weird Ireland. So, Brinsley, next we're going to visit County Wexford, where there's a very haunted place. It's called Loftus Hall.
Loftus Hall. So, there's a lot of places people call the most haunted place in Ireland. Loftus Hall gets called it the most. It's a manor house in South Wexford on the Hook Peninsula. And it's now a big abandoned building, but for years before that, it was a very popular place for ghost hunters. Because I had a legend to do with the devil visiting one night. What happened was a survivor off a shipwreck came to Loftus Hall and asked for somewhere to, you know, dry off and stay for the night. And of course, they're welcoming. They let him in. Next thing, they're playing cards with this visitor. Somebody drops a card, bends over, looks down. The visitor has hooves like a goat instead of feet. And he's the devil. And he shoots out this healing in a bolt of fire. So that's the very famous devil story with
He shoots
Loftus
out
Hall.
A what in a bolt of fire?
He turns into fire and shoots out the ceiling.
Oh, he just rockets right through the ceiling?
Seemingly, yeah.
My goodness. And now today, tourists go there?
No, it was actually very popular with, like, how do you call it, ghost tourists. It was very popular with ghost tourists, ghost hunters, even 5 years ago. Now it's closed up. You can see the outside of it, but you can't go into it.
Now, you said this haunted Loftus house, it's on Hook Peninsula. A lot of people, when they wanted to get there, they'd get there by hook or by crook, right?
That's where that expression seemingly comes from. I believe that comes from Cromwell's invasions of Ireland in the 17th century. He wanted to reach a certain town, and he says, I'll do it either by hook or by crook. And by hook, he meant by the Hook Peninsula. And by crook, he meant another town on the far side of it. So that's what the expression comes from.
I love that. There's so many expressions that go back to Ireland, and there's a historical reason for them. Another weird happening, and one that I found very interesting, is what you call the Las Vegas of apparitions. An apparition, am I pronouncing that right? It's when you get a vision, like the at Fatima, when the farm kids saw Mary up in the sky during World War I. And a lot of places all over the world, all different religions, you see these spiritual, mystical images somewhere. And County Mayo has a place called Knock, K-N-O-C-K, which just seems to be the center of all these apparitions. Tell us about Mass at Knock Peninsula.
Well, I was being probably facetious when I called it the Las Vegas of apparitions, but the reason it was because it is the place for the Virgin Mary appearance in Ireland. So basically, in the 19th century, there was a vision of the Virgin Mary appearing in Knock, what was and still is a very small village in Ireland, outside of one of the churches. It was reported by a lot of people, and there's a lot of very interesting ideas about it. Some people believe it could have been a very early film projection that they saw. It was a hoax.
But this is 1879, right?
Yeah, but there was still very rudimentary equipment like that back then.
Yeah. Well, that would have blown people away who didn't know that there was this technology about having a video projection. And then was there like miracles from that?
There was a lot of people healed. Many were healed at Knock, or at least many claimed to be healed from, I think, walking issues, from breathing issues, all this sort of thing. There's great documenting of that. And I think what's pretty cool about Knock these days is it's still a small town, but it has a 5,000 capacity cathedral inside of it, a very, very modern one. It has four churches, I think, in it too. It's a real huge spectacle when you go there.
So this town's economy is pilgrims wanting to go to where these miracles happened.
Absolutely, yeah. And selling as many things with the Virgin Mary on as they can, you know, in the shops there too.
So that's part of the economy. In much of Europe, Southern Europe especially, when there are miracles and or just answers to prayers, people put a plaque in the church that has their eyes or their heart or their broken leg or whatever healed as a thank you. Do you have those kind of plaques in the churches in Ireland?
Probably, but another thing that's very similar and very Irish is votive offerings at Holy
votive,
Wells or
that's
retreats.
The word I was searching for, a votive offering, yeah.
A votive offering, yeah. You don't see that in churches as much. You see it in, if you have a holy well and you have a tree next to it, they will be covered in those kinds of things.
Oh, there you go. So in Italy, you'll have those votive offerings in the chapel at the church. In Ireland, you have it down the street at the holy well, which has a
Absolutely.
Little bit of paganism mixed into the Catholicism.
Definitely. When you see the places, it gives you much more that kind of a view of a kind of pagan site for sure.
Tell us more about holy wells.
Oh boy, there could be 1,000 or more of them in Ireland. They are wells, places, water sources that are normally associated with a saint or a holy person and normally have some kind of a traditional folk cure attached to it. For example, a lot of them will have a cure for warts, wart cures. That's very common.
So you can get your warts cured if you go to a holy well. You don't have to go to a pharmacy.
No, not at all. Yeah, seemingly it works at a holy well, or breathing diseases, or headaches,
wow.
Headache cures, that's common as well, yeah.
Oh, well, on that great note, I'm just going to thank you for giving us another dimension of the Emerald Isle and the Isle of the Saints and Scholars and the Isle of Weird, Weird Things. Brinsley McNamara, thanks so much, and weird travels to you.
Great, thank you, Rick.
You'll find links to Brinsley McNamara's Weird Ireland with this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Back before the Middle Ages, the need to trade goods replaced plundering as a way for the Vikings to interact with the rest of the world. In a minute, Norwegian tour guide Paul Johansen recommends places to visit in Scandinavia, places where you can get in touch with the history and the spirit of Viking ancestors. It's Travel with Rick Steves.
Ich reise mit Rick Steves. I'm Ursula Klaus from Vienna, and that was, in Viennese German, I travel with Rick Steves. Ich reise mit Rick Steves. Thank you.
The days of the Vikings may be long gone in Scandinavia, but those legendary warriors and seafarers continue to capture our imagination. In Norway and in the rest of Nordic Europe, we can still encounter Viking sites, each telling a tale of exploration, conquest, and cultural legacy. To help us uncover the Vikings' fierce and famous past, we're joined today by Paul Johansen. He's a guide based in Oslo and one of my go-to sources for all things Scandinavian. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be on the show.
You know, Viking culture is just fascinating to any of us dreaming of going to Scandinavia, but a lot of us don't really have a clear idea of what it is. Just give us a little context here. What was Viking culture? Where was it? When was it? Why is it important?
When we talk about the Viking culture and the Viking era, it brings us back to the late 700s, where we have a period from the late 700s up until the mid-11th century, more or less, which is known as the Viking era in Scandinavia. And that's when these people lived, these seafaring marauders, which were more than that. Also, there were some great craftsmen and they were great traders. There's a lot of interest in this subject here in Scandinavia, in Norway, and also from travelers who come from abroad.
I understand in Norway, every culture divides ancient, medieval, and modern a different way. You can't say in the year 500 it went from ancient to medieval everywhere. It depends on where people were in their evolutionary story as they evolved. And I've heard that the changeover from ancient to medieval was when the Viking culture went from pagan to Christian. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I would say so. That's when we think of when the Middle Ages starts. That's when the Viking Age ends, which there's actually an end year, 1066, at the Battle of Stamford Bridge.
Why was that such a big deal? The one battle spells the end of ancient times, the beginning of medieval times, in a town that I don't even know.
Well, there was a very fierce Viking. His name was Harald the Ruthless. He was a Norwegian Viking, and he brought a big army with him from Norway, and he wanted to conquer England. He fought a battle at Stamford Bridge. He lost, and this is seen as the last great Viking battle, and also the end of the Viking Age.
Huh. But that was in England.
That was in England.
And that battle meant the end of the Viking Age in Norway. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's interesting. Of course, this is just a year, 1066. It was a transition that went, over much longer time.
That was the Norman conquest. That 1066, every historian knows, that's when the Normans came over and William the Bastard became William the Conqueror.
Yeah, and there are, of course, many reasons why the Viking Age ended then. But it, of course, it has to do with Christianity coming to Scandinavia. It has to do with also the fact that other countries that the Vikings used to raid and attack, they became better prepared against the Viking raids. So it became increasingly harder to be a Viking. And what do you do when you can't steal it? Then you trade instead.
So you went from stealers to traders, because that was what I was going to ask you, because we hear this rape, pillage, and plunder phrase, Of course, it's a little bit of a rough term, but if you wanted to characterize Viking relations with the rest of Europe, it was rape, pillage, and plunder?
I think that's a bit of a stereotype that has been shaped, the last 100 years or so. I think there was much more to the Vikings than that. I think for sure some of the Vikings, they were real pirates and they did all those things. Others were basically family men. They were farmers most of the year. And then once or twice they would take their boat out and they would, sail across the North Sea and bring some treasures with them home. But they wouldn't necessarily rape and pillage all of them. At least that's my opinion.
Okay, so let me step away from my movie images, my cliches. And we'll talk about just a society of people that lived in a very difficult environment that had to eke out a living with long winters and lots of fires burning down their villages, families to raise, and it was difficult times. Tell us about a more workaday image of Vikings. What was life like in the year 900 in Norway?
Well, I think apart from or unlike, you could say, parts of southern Europe, for instance, where people tended to live in villages, in Scandinavia, people lived on their farm. Mm-hmm. So each man would live on his farm, and villages were just a place where trading took place. So you lived on your farm, and you would farm most of the year to provide for your family. You would stock up, throughout the summer and the harvest so that it could last through the winter. And then perhaps, a neighbor came over from a neighboring farm and he told you that, hey, last summer I took my boat and went over to this land to the west. There was a group of 10 of us and we stole with us a bunch of gold and silver. And it was so easy. We could just walk straight into these brick buildings. They were unguarded, just some people in robes running away. You want to come join?
People in robes running away.
Yeah.
To hear you, you're such a dear soul, and to hear you talk about your great 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 grandfather like that, they were just a bunch of peaceful people in robes running away, and we took their silver and their gold.
So wow. Of course, when it sounds so easy to get all this wealth all this silver and gold. Of course, you want to join in next year. So regular farmers, regular men, family men became Vikings in that sense.
They'd have that hunting season when it was...
The
winds were right and they could go over and I'm fascinated by the fact, I believe, that much of Europe, for many generations, when they said their prayer, they didn't say amen, but they said in their own language, and deliver us from the Viking, and deliver us from the Norsemen, amen. That was the standard close of a prayer if you lived in the west coast of France or England.
Yes, for sure it was. They sent shockwaves throughout all of Europe.
And a lot of people underestimate the reach of the Vikings. I understand the word Russia is from an old Norwegian word, which was for the Vikings, the Rus.
Well, from what I heard, this was a tribe from Sweden, actually, from the area of Ruslage, which made it into what is today Russia, settled there. And so that's where the name Russia comes from.
Okay. And Normandy, Normandy, a very important part of France. It comes from the root Norman, the Northmen, the Vikings who settled there, and they became good citizens, I guess.
Yeah. Land of the Norsemen. They made it all the way to Constantinople as well.
Wow. Paul Johansen is a licensed travel guide based in Oslo, as well as a sailor, filmmaker, and writer. He's helped me research the Rick Steves Scandinavia Guidebook. Pal also offers custom tours and trip planning advice and profiles the cities, regions, and fjords of Norway on his website, norwaywithpal.com. He also runs a YouTube channel under that name, and Pal is spelled P-A-L. Hey, we're talking about Vikings, and this is a travel show. Let's talk about Viking sightseeing. I know the big news in Oslo is the wonderful Viking ships museum out in Bygdøy across the harbor from Oslo has been closed for years, and people have had to look other places for their Viking sites. What's the status of the big Viking museum in Oslo, and what is your advice for seeing the best real artifacts? Because there is another place in Oslo that was open because this major museum was closed, and there was no artifacts there. And I don't like paying $20 to go into a place where there's no historic artifacts. I can sit down and read a book for that, you know. But talk about artifacts and the future of Viking sightseeing in Norway.
You have some excellent options for Viking sites in Scandinavia. First of all, I can mention that you have the Viking Ship Museum, which you mentioned is closed, which will reopen in 2027 as the Museum of the Viking Age. And will contain the three ships that have been found. And it will also contain one of the largest collections of artifacts in the world, Viking artifacts in the world. So really something to look forward to.
And that's still in Bygdøy?
That's still in Bygdøy, in the same spot. They're making it bigger. It's going to be three times bigger.
So just so people know, if you're going to the best open-air folk museum in Norway, if you're going to see the Fram, the Arctic Exploration Vessel, or the Kon-Tiki, it's all right together there, a 10-minute ferry ride across from the harbor in Oslo. And it's a wonderful day out. In 2027, we'll have the Museum of the Viking Age. Sounds like better than ever. I interrupted you. Carry on for more sites on Vikings.
So meanwhile, I would say the best Viking sites you find in Sweden and Denmark. In Sweden, in Stockholm, the capital, they have a great exhibition at the Historical Museum, where they have a collection of 2,500 objects. So it's a really good exhibition. So I would not miss that.
I was just there, and as a Norwegian, it pained me to say that the best Viking sites right now are in Stockholm. But it's an amazing museum just out near the Vasa and Skansen, but on the mainland, not across the bridge.
That's correct. So I definitely wouldn't miss that. And then if you're going to Denmark, to Copenhagen, for instance, then I would jump on a train and I would go out to the Roskilde Museum, Viking Ship Museum, where they have five original Viking ships. But what I like the most about actually that museum is that they have an outdoor shipyard. So you can actually see how these ships were built. And see shipbuilders in action, you know, splitting the logs and hammering in the iron nails. And it's really fascinating.
You know, when you talked about that those ships, because I've seen those ships, and apparently they scuttled those ships 1,000 years ago to block the harbor. And then in modern times, they were sunk intentionally there and they brought them up and remarkably well preserved. It's rare to find wooden artifacts from the Viking Age because wood does not survive 1,000 years, especially in a land that's cold and wet and wants to have fires to stay warm and dry. And people burn each other's houses when they get mad at each other. There's really, it's kind of rare to find wooden treasures from 1,000 years ago, isn't it?
It is very rare. So whatever is found inside burial mounds or on the bed of the sea, basically.
So in a nutshell, for Viking sites, I think you summed it up very nicely. Wonderful museum in Stockholm. Roskilde, which is a city, a great city with a wonderful heritage where most of the royalty is buried in the church there. You have the Viking Ships Museum in Roskilde in Denmark, about an hour from Copenhagen. And in Oslo, which is going to be the best of all of them, I think, when it opens. Until 2027, it's closed. So Norway's out of the running for great Viking artifacts until 2027 when it comes back. But what you also have around Scandinavia are megalithic sites, stones, sacred places, burial grounds, burial mounds. I've been to several places in Scandinavia where you can find stones like Stonehenge, you know, but erected in the shape of a Viking ship. And apparently that would be a ceremonial burial ground 1,000 years ago. There was one in my uncle's backyard, essentially, in Sandefjord, south of Oslo. There's a wonderful one on the island outside of Kalmar in Sweden. And there's also up in Balestrand, there's a mound with a burial from a Viking king. That's a fascinating thing. Talk a little bit about archaeological sites and burial mounds and big stones that were put up 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice sites as well where you can see stones and burial mounds. Perhaps my favorite is just a bit south of Oslo in a place called Horten. It's called the Midgard Viking Center. And they have a collection of burial mounds. It's really fascinating. It's a big open area. This was obviously a sort of a Viking stronghold 1,000 years ago. And there are just tons of burial mounds there. And you can walk among them. You can walk on top of them even. And they also have built a replica of a Viking longhouse there. So it's a great site just outside of Oslo, just south
and
of
the
Oslo.
Name is, what is the name of that again?
Midgard Viking Center.
Midgard Viking Center. You know, you mentioned in the 11th century, the Vikings went from being pagans and plunderers to being Christian and more settled down and having to trade. And their shipbuilding skills, it seems to me, were translated into church-building skills. And they built these beautiful stav churches. And again, they're wooden, so a lot of them did not survive. But a lot of them have. To me, that's the sort of the echo of the Viking spirit. It still lived on through the Middle Ages and right up today. What's your advice on stav churches and seeing those?
Well, there's about 29 stav churches left. You can find one in Oslo at the Open Air Folk Museum. Except for that, you find them pretty much scattered all over the west side, the western parts of Norway in the fjord country. I think that's a real highlight when you come to Norway to visit one of these stave churches.
To think they're 800 years old, they were built by the Viking culture, essentially, and they've survived. And they must have had a sense of a good view because they are situated so idyllically, so beautifully in fjord country. For some people, they can think, oh, if you've seen one, you've seen them all. But I've visited four or five great Viking stav churches, and they are beautiful.
They're all different. They all have their history, their charm. Of course, they are decorated with Christian symbols, but many are decorated with dragon heads and you find, you know, pagan symbols on the inside and so on. So it can really tell you a lot about the minds of the people that lived back then and that you were in this transition between, you know, being pagans and becoming Christians and having a foot in each religion could probably be a wise choice.
Pragmatic choice. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Paul Johansen. Paul's YouTube channel and his website are simply Norway with Paul, and that's spelled P-A-L. You know, Paul, I'm a Norwegian-American, and I seem to want to celebrate the Viking in me, but I don't know why. You're Norwegian. Do you celebrate the Viking in you, or just to close it off with a thought, what does Viking mean to you?
That's a really good question, Rick. I think we celebrate the Vikings in a lot of ways, but we're not so aware of it. You know, a lot of the big traditions that we have in Scandinavia, like for instance, Christmas, which is called Jul in Norwegian, It's actually a word for an old Viking sacrifice that took place. So in many ways, we are celebrating the Vikings, but we might not be so aware of it anymore.
And way over here, as far as the Vikings wandered in the northwest of the United States, my grandmother, my dear grandmother, rest her soul, she would say, "Good Yule."
Mm-hmm. Good Yule, which means happy midwinter sacrifice.
So she would tell me Merry Christmas by saying happy midwinter sacrifice. Well, Paul, good travels to you and good teaching as a wonderful tour guide, and tusen takk for joining us and sharing a fascinating glimpse into Norway's Viking heritage.
Thank you. Tusen takk, Rick.
The same thirst for adventure that led the Vikings to sail far from home has taken scores of fearless travelers across the interior of Asia. When I did it as a college-age vagabond, we called it following the hippie trail. Kate Harris did postgraduate scientific studies with travel to Mars in mind. But when she planned a very long-distance bicycle adventure from Istanbul to the Himalayas, her inspiration was the historic Silk Road adventures of Marco Polo. Up next, one of Canada's foremost modern-day explorers tells us about pedaling for weeks across some of the world's most remote terrain in the former Soviet stands of Asia and on a long uphill climb to the Himalayas. It's getting wild in the lands of lost borders, next on Travel with Rick Steves. Kate Harris grew up wanting to be a globe-trotting explorer, so she invited a childhood friend to join her on a bike ride across Asia along the fabled Silk Road. From Turkey to Tajikistan, and even sneaking into Tibet, they had quite an adventure, and she writes about it in her book, Lands of Lost Borders. Kate Harris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
What an epic bike ride. Now, before we get into the big discussion, can you just give us a quick outline of where the trip went, countries, how long were you on the road, and so on?
Sure. We traveled through 10 countries in between Turkey and India, and it took us 10 months in total, and it was around 10,000 kilometers. I know this is America, so
that's right.
Put that
6,000 miles.
Not sure.
Yeah. 6,000 miles. Whoa. On the bike over 10 months, all across Asia. You looped around through China and ended up in Kashmir, northern India.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. Now, why? Just why? That's a lot of biking over 10 miles in places where there's no guidebook to help you out.
Yeah, that's true. We could have used some of your guidebooks out there in the stands, especially. Why? Mostly sheer curiosity and desire to know what's around the next bend. And I was fascinated with the Silk Road as a child. My mother had this book that I loved that had been hers as a child. And it was this illustrated, abridged edition of Marco Polo's travels. And he just looked like the consummate explorer to me, you know, like rugged and bold and gazing off at distant, fantastic horizons.
The Silk Road, I think of it as, well, it was a trading route back in the days of Marco Polo that took you from China to the gateway to Europe, kind of, in Turkey or something. But physically, what is the Silk Road? And what do you see when you spend 10 months biking on it? Is there anything that goes back that can evoke the days of Marco Polo?
Yeah, well, the Silk Road is really a label we've put on to a network of roads that were trading routes between Europe and Asia. So they ferried goods, people, and ideas back and forth. It's still alive and well in a lot of ways. Essentially, in a lot of the historic trading hubs that Marco Polo visited, you can still see original architecture dating back to that era.
What century was that with Marco Polo?
13th century.
So the 1200s, so 800 years ago, 300 years before Columbus or centuries before Vasco da Gama and Magellan and so on. This was before they knew the world was round, and it was just, must have been just so exciting to connect the West with the East. And so when you think about your bike ride, if you describe it, I was reading through the chapters on Georgia, for instance, and it sounded, Georgia, former Soviet Union, it sounded pretty grim and dull out there a lot of the times. What was it like day after day, 100 miles after 100 miles, pedaling across these vast expanses?
Yeah, well, part of the dullness of Georgia, Georgia's an incredible country, and I would love to go back, but in the summertime, because we were there in the winter, and so it was pretty gray and cold a lot of the time, but the warmth of the people we met along the way definitely made up for that. I feel like there's so many ways to travel, and cycling in particular exposes you to the world around you in a way that few other modes do, you know, if you're on a bus or a train. The other thing we notice with cycling is that everyone rides bikes everywhere along the Silk Road. They use them to get to work, go out for a joyride. We would pass just like masses of school kids heading to school on bicycles, and we'd join them for a little spell.
It must have been fun for them to see a couple of women from Canada on bikes and just plopping into their world.
Alien invaders, I think they saw us in that category.
Was there a circle of travelers that could share information? Or I've never seen a guidebook for this, quote, Silk Road. Did you get information online? Or how did you know how to cross borders and what to eat where and where you might sleep or what you might see in the middle of Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan or whatever as you were biking across?
We'd essentially do big information gathering sessions when we had access to the internet in some of the bigger cities. And in between that, we were kind of on our own. We would get information from families we stayed with that welcomed us into their homes or other cyclists going the other way. So we'd chat with them. It's a quite popular cycling route. I mean, lots of people bike the Silk Road.
There's a lot of experience out there, and there are ways to share information. I remember when I took the bus ride when I was a backpacker from Istanbul all the way to Kashmir, where you ended up. People had to share information, and there was a hunger for information, and there was you'd meet the same people all along the route, because this was the route, the hippie trail to India from Europe, you know. Is there a dimension of that for biking the Silk Road? Did you meet other travelers at hostels in the middle of nowhere and so on?
Yeah, there are certainly places where we all seem to congregate, because there are so many variations on the Silk Road that you can follow, but everyone seemed to show up in Kashgar, for example, or Dushanbe in Tajikistan. And that was in part due to embassies. These were the places where you had to get the visas you needed to continue traveling.
Oh, so you're just hanging out waiting for your visas to be processed.
Yeah. Yeah. Swapping stories. And
what about shots? Did you have to worry about shots when you crossed a border?
Shots like
inoculations?
Oh, vaccinations?
Yeah.
No. No, we were never.
That was a big deal back in the old days, crossing a border. Everybody had their yellow vaccination record sheet. And if you didn't have the right shots on your yellow vaccination sheet, you had to wait until tomorrow when the nurse came in. And I'll never forget being at a border and watching the needle bend as they put it into my friend's arm. It was such an old needle. And I thought, you can't cross the border unless you get the shot. So you don't have to worry about that now. Did you have to worry? You went through 10 different countries. You crossed 10 borders. Did you need visas, or did you just say, hi, I'm a Canadian and we're biking around?
Oh, I wish it were that easy. We certainly needed visas, and that was one of the biggest headaches of the trip. Central Asia in particular, all the stands, I don't know what it was like when you went through. I guess it was all part of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, the visas are, tourist visas are very restrictive. Like, you have to enter on a certain date and leave on a certain assigned date. And so lining those up was sort of like this elaborate game of chess with the different rules that operate in Uzbekistan versus Kazakhstan versus Kyrgyzstan. And
was that done one capital at a time? So you'd be in Uzbekistan and you'd go to the capital of Tajikistan or you'd go to the capital city to get your visa or learn what you needed for the next country down the road. Did you kind of think one country ahead, or did you have it all laid out from the beginning?
There was a bit of a strategy. So you had to think at least one country ahead. So, for example, to get our Chinese visa en route, the only country in all of Central Asia that was granting Chinese tourist visas to foreigners was in Uzbekistan. And so at one point, it looked like we wouldn't be able to get to Uzbekistan. Our visas were denied the first time, and we just thought the whole trip was fragmented at that point because we couldn't weave together a route that would get us to China.
But you talked about slipping through a border at night when nobody was there. Now, that just seems
not
like
advisable.
You're looking for trouble. You literally snuck into a country when nobody was at the border just because you thought, heck, we got places to go.
No, it wasn't a border per se. It was, although in the past it has been, we basically snuck into the Tibetan Autonomous Region within China. So this used to be Tibet, independent nation, and now it's a regional boundary. And they have checkpoints that restrict access mostly to locals. They're quite concerned about locals leaving that region. So we snuck in because as foreigners, you need permits, special permits, and guides. And the permits really restrict where you can go within the Tibetan Autonomous Region. And we didn't want to be let around on a leash. And so we snuck in.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by explorer Kate Harris, and she and her childhood girlfriend biked all across the fabled Silk Road. And she writes about that in her book, called Lands of Lost Borders. Today, Kate calls remote northern British Columbia her home. Her website is kateharris.ca. Hey, Kate, your book is called Lands of Lost Borders. Why that title?
Well, the borders were certainly not lost in a political sense and physical sense. You know, we saw lots of walls and needed a lot of visas to travel the Silk Road. But I was hoping to evoke the idea that, you know, travel is about breaking down the borders in your own mind, most of all, and seeing the world differently and seeing ambiguities where before you saw things in black and white. So those are the lost borders I'm referring to.
And did you come away with that souvenir from your trip?
Absolutely.
How so?
I guess I have a deepened appreciation for complexity and just how complicated things are in countries that operate very differently from Canada and the U.S.
You know, I've wondered about that too, because we could just say, oh, they don't have a democracy. Let's throw out their leader and get them a democracy. But it's probably more complicated than that.
Yeah, as Afghanistan is testament to. I think there's a way of, I don't know, we do things a certain way here in North America and think that that can be exported and successful in a different cultural context. And that's so often not the case. One of the stories I like to hold up from traveling through Tajikistan is the fact that national parks there, in the form of sectioned off parcels of land that supposedly have rangers that patrol it and protect the wildlife and ecosystems within it, just don't work. They're some of the most or the least biodiverse parts of Tajikistan. Hmm. And the most biodiverse parts of Tajikistan happen to be within like hunting conservancies, because foreigners will pay a lot of money to trophy hunt a Marco Polo sheep, for example. And that money supports the protection of Marco Polo sheep, which supports protection of snow leopards by extension. Hmm. And so the whole ecosystem is kind of held up by trophy hunting, which, you know, in Sierra Club card holding members back home, that's not really a appealing approach to conservation. But when you have a country as poor as Tajikistan that has few other options for doing conservation the way we do it here, it makes you think twice.
Okay, let's go through your trip now, Kate. Just very quickly, after pedaling 6,000 miles, what was the most jaw-dropping view you can remember from your bike?
Oh my gosh, that's a challenging question.
Or one of the best.
One of the best? We biked through Uzbekistan. I get all the stands mixed up even now. At night, for the most part, because it was so hot by day in the deserts of Central Asia that it was pretty much insufferable to ride. And so we would camp out all day and swelter in our tent and then set off as the sunset and ride through the night until sort of dusk, and then we'd kind of crash. And biking at night under the stars, I feel like I came to know that country more by its constellations than by any terrestrial landmarks. It was absolutely surreal to be sort of flying through the stars in this incredibly flat desert where they seem to come right down to earth.
What was the scariest close call? You pedaled 6,000 miles. Did you feel safe on your bike?
We did, for the most part. Certainly, in terms of the people we met, we never felt at risk in the slightest. The scariest part was traffic. You know, you're on the road with transport trucks and cars that aren't used to seeing cyclists in some cases, and they'll pass by as close as possible and honk their horn and wave, and it's the friendliest gesture imaginable, but you're terrified for your life.
In the middle of nowhere, you don't have a 911 you can call.
No.
I was just talking to somebody about safety for travel, and by far, the biggest cause of deaths for travelers is road accidents in countries where there's no 911 service.
Yeah, I believe it.
What was the? Did you ever get really discouraged or depressed halfway through your 10-month odyssey and think, why did we do this? Or maybe your friend said, what are we doing here? And you just felt like almost aborting the mission.
Oh, gosh. I almost wanted to abort the first week when we were in Turkey, and it was January, and we were on the Black Sea coast, so it was extremely rainy, and it would sort of hover around being freezing rain and then would sort of lean into being snow. So we were just soaking wet all the time. And the Black Sea coast is very corrugated. So we were either going up or down, and we'd be super hot as we went up and then freezing cold as we went down. It was just a really hard start to the trip. Mm. And it wasn't the sort of dreamy, romantic expedition that I had envisioned. It was just hard. And I'm glad it came at the beginning of the trip. Yeah.
I remember doing that my odyssey was nothing like yours, but I started and ended in the same spot from Istanbul to Kashmir. And I remember getting onto that, and they actually had a map that was the hippie trail from Turkey to India. And this map was long. It was like long, skinny map, and you'd open it up and it had like six or eight panels as you opened it longer and longer and longer to from the left to the right. And we would be on bus for a couple of days and we'd open up this thing and it's like, we've gone nowhere. This is going to take us forever. And you must have had a similar sense of that when you started pedaling out of Istanbul thinking, so we're going to China, huh?
Yeah. And that's what people would ask us, like, where are you going? And we'd say, Hindustan, which is what they call India in Turkey.
It was that nuts.
They would just laugh.
I can imagine that. What was that? Was there a euphoric moment that comes to mind over the whole trip?
I think the final pass on the road through Tibet. So we'd been sneaking illegally across Tibet the whole time. And we came to the final pass, which is past Everest base camp turn off. You're in the heart of the highest mountains in the world. And then you plunge from, I think it's about 16, 17,000 feet all the way down to 3,000 feet in Nepal. Mm-hmm. And so you go through sort of this lunar barren landscape and then get lower and there's more foliage and you get even lower and it starts to feel tropical. It was just an incredible day and 100 kilometers of pure downhill from that high pass.
And this was
Nepal.
Coming into Ladakh?
Into Nepal, actually.
Into
so
Nepal,
we had to kind of do this, as you described, this like spiral in to get to northern India. Mostly because of borders. At one point, we were in Tajikistan. We were like 400 kilometers from our final destination, but we had to go 4,000 kilometers to get there because of borders.
Kate Harris is the kind of person who really doesn't let a border tell her no. For one thing, she lives off-grid in a cabin not far from the Yukon near Atlin, British Columbia. She's joining us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives and the CBC studios in Toronto. Kate writes about her long-distance cycling adventures across Asia in her book Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road. It won a number of prestigious literary awards when it was released back in 2019. And she's still working on a second memoir about what she calls Wanderlust Gone Local. Kate's posted photos and videos from her cycling adventures with her partner Mel, with links to articles she's written. It's on her website, kateharris.ca. And she's on Facebook and Instagram. Kate is also a facility editor at the Wilderness Writers Retreat at Port Renfrew on Vancouver Island, BC. I remember when I was traveling across Asia, I would almost measure how far I was from my destination by how many borders I had to cross. What was it coming up to a border on a bike when you're surrounded by, a lot of times at these borders, you have a long line of trucks and cargo that's waiting to get across. Did you ever find a huge backup and you could go straight to the front, or were you just stuck there with everybody else who was laying on blankets under their trucks for days on end?
I can tell you've traveled this route because, things have not changed in that respect. We would essentially jump the line with people's encouragement. So we'd bike right up to the front.
So but truckers would be waiting there for days and they'd see you guys and they'd go ahead, go right to the front and get to the front. And hopefully you've got everything in your passport in order.
Yeah, we were always afraid at every border that they'd find some reason not to let us through, especially in the stands where they're very wary of foreigners, for one, but especially journalists. And so we would always get asked, like, are you a journalist? And no.
So you just said
tourism.
Told
them I'm a writer.
Writer.
You just said tourist.
Tourist, that's the easiest way to cross a border. I'm just a silly tourist. Did you ever have
that's
to bribe
right.
your... Did you ever find yourself in a position where you had to bribe your way out of trouble or bribe to make something happen?
Sort of. So in Uzbekistan, we needed to have proof of where we'd stayed each night. And since we were spending many nights in a tent, this was impossible. And so we found a hotel and the hotel concierge was willing to, for a sum of money... willing to backdate a bunch of these receipts to fill in the gaps. And so we were so proud of ourselves.
They probably knew that tourists needed it, and they had a little business of adding overnights.
Or they knew we didn't need it, as it turned out, because we were so excited to show our bribed receipts at the exit border heading into Tajikistan from Uzbekistan, and they didn't even ask for them. I feel like it was a big make-work project.
Oh, my goodness. But you never know. You don't want to go to the border and not be prepared.
Yeah. They have a lot of power, these borders.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Kate Harris. Her book is Lands of Lost Borders, A Journey on the Silk Road, talking about her epic bike ride. Kate, after this huge investment of time and energy and emotion, what do you take home from this adventure that you set out on?
Well, it's so easy to despair about the state of the world based on what we hear in the news. And in some cases, that despair is justified, but I really... feel like if you hit the road, especially by bicycle, and travel at all, anywhere, you'll see that the world is full of incredible, kind people who mostly want the same things that you do. And it's an incredibly hopeful undertaking. I don't think you can come back from a trip like this without feeling a lot of hope for the future, which is hard to come by if you pick up a newspaper.
I think the world would be a better place if everybody had a few days to be on a bicycle in Tajikistan.
I completely agree.
Kate Harris, thank you so much for sharing your adventure and happy continued biking.
Thank you, Rick. It was a joy talking to you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tappan, Kasmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirk upload the shows to our website. Jerry Frank wrote and performed our theme music. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher, dreaming of trekking the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my journal and vivid photos from that coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary hippie trail. My book, On the Hippie Trail, is available wherever books are sold.